Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest installment in our series, the Bloomberg Global Asset Owners Forum. We are delighted you could join us today. My name is Eric Schatzker. I'm an editor at large with Bloomberg here in New York City. And our guest today is none other than Nassim Taleb. You may know Nassim as the options trader he once was, or perhaps as a distinguished professor of risk engineering at New York University, or more likely as the author of best-selling books, including The Black Swan. Nassim, welcome. Are you there?
Thank you. Nice to have a conversation with you again.
Great to see you as always. Nassim, I want to tell everybody that not only are you not here with me in New York City, you're in Northern Lebanon, and you've taken time out of your busy schedule to be with us, and we're very grateful.
Thank you.
I'm going to be conducting a virtual fireside chat with Nassim, and on your screen, you'll see there is a way to submit questions. Please do, and I will do my best to incorporate them into our conversation. There will be no portion set aside for explicit audience Q&A. I want to see these. They're going to pop up on my screen, and as I say, I'll try to work them into our conversation. Nassim, I want to begin by reminding people what you are not. You're not a strategist, you're not an analyst, you're not a soothsayer. More than anything else, I think of you as an independent thinker. Some people might call you a contrarian. I'd also describe you as a philosopher, a mathematician, a logician, and a student of volatility and risk. Tell me, how would you describe yourself?
As someone who deals with probability. Definitely not a contrarian. There are a lot of things I agree with, but I would say someone who deals with risk and probability, tail risk and probability. And also as an advisor to Universal Investments.
Investments is a firm that specializes in providing tail risk protection
exactly.
to investors, and that's the subject we're going to delve into a little bit later in our conversation. But right now, Nassim, I want to remind people
Tail risk across disciplines has been my specialty forever. And when I look at COVID, I think in terms of COVID, in terms of tail risk. And I came from finance and, of course, became a little more multidisciplinary later.
Yeah, multidisciplinary is an understatement. Nassim, one of your gifts is revealing to people the fallacies of their assumptions, right? Assumptions about predictability, assumptions about resiliency, assumptions about authority, let's say, and of course, prompting them to look at the world they inhabit in a different and often surprising way. You've written about the misconceptions, I might call them the fallacies, in fact, you've called them the fallacies, that sprung up to explain the pandemic and to predict its course. And your criticism is directed at academics, but it applies much more broadly. And my question to you is this, what is it that people are getting so wrong about the pandemic?
This was summarized because we engaged in a public scientific debate with Professor Ioannidis at Stanford, who was taking, early on the position that COVID there was no evidence COVID was harmful, and therefore we had to argue from the standpoint of logical fallacies that there's a difference between absence of evidence, evidence of absence. And this, of course, grew into a full-fledged scientific debate that covers many, many aspects. The first fallacy is, of course, that you should not react early. You see, our point is it's much cheaper to react very early to the pandemic than wait. People don't realize that. Second point is that pandemics have the fattest-tailed attributes you can find in anything. In other words, most of them are going to be of no big consequence, and a few of them, maybe just one, will be a monstrous consequence. So you really cannot ignore them. It's what we call the tail wagging the dog. That's the second misconception. A third misconception, and that's a very severe one, is to think there's a trade-off between the economy and the pandemic. In other words, that the closing, that reacting to the pandemic has an economic cost, forgetting that the pandemic, it's the pandemic itself that's inflicting these costs on us, on society. and series of things that flow from this misunderstanding. And we managed to publish in Nature Physics, PNAS, you know, the main journals, part of that debate, and it's still going on scientifically with a group of friends and collaborators to try to explain to people that just as you deal with a portfolio and its tail risk, just like you would deal with your house and the tail risk of losing your house, you should react early when it's very cheap, okay, and have built-in natural insurance against pandemics.
So let's bring in a real-world example. The United States, as you know, has attracted a great deal of attention for the failings of its response to the pandemic. Where would you say the misconceptions or the fallacies that you've just described were evident in the way that this country responded to the pandemic?
We started reacting in January. And in January, the Trump administration took us seriously by shutting down the border with China. But they did not follow through with that. You do not need a full lockdown or anything. You need to find the most efficient way to reduce the multiplicative growth effect of a pandemic. And at the time, there was that prevailing thinking to compare numbers like so many people died of COVID and how many people are dying, drowning in a swimming pool. So why are we paying so much attention to something that doesn't kill a lot of people? And the way we explained it is, no, things scale differently. If I drown in my swimming pool, my neighbor is not likely to drown in her or his swimming pool. But if I die of COVID, my neighbor is vastly more likely to die of COVID. And the third neighbor is even more likely to die of COVID because they have multiplicated growth. Now, what do you do in the presence of something that has such multiplicated effects? You try to bring down the multiplication. It turned out, and we started suggesting face masks, and there were a lot of mistakes with face masks initially. Instead of studying how the biology of face masks works, because you're not going to get it easily that way, it will take you years before you figure out. We looked at the data in countries where face masks are custom. And we also looked at something very simple, and I said it on your program, if I wear a face mask and you wear a face mask, we don't reduce probabilities and a face mask protects you by, say, 50%, we reduce the probability of infection by 75%. And furthermore, if a face mask reduces the viral load by only half, you may reduce the probability of infection by 99%. Because of nonlinearities, because of the virus is very viral load dependent. So you have to do anything to cut the viral load at the local level and to cut the super spreaders. And that was a tactical strategy. Cut the super spreaders, face masks, and constrain some movement. And the governments worldwide were very slow, outside of China, of course, and Asia, where they have a lot more, more of a risk culture. The governments were slow, and then the more you wait, the more it's going to be costly. Had we had face masks in February, I think we would be having this conversation. We'd be talking now about the election or the bull market or something else, because it wouldn't have been a thing here, just like it's no longer a thing in Asia, if we had face masks. So you have to focus strategically on what can demultiply and cause the multiplicative effect to be less acute. And there are simple solutions. Super spreader events. Everything fat-tailed comes from super spreader events, i.e. a urologist conference, not very glamorous, but these bring a lot of people from all around the world to Las Vegas, where they come in and respread. So these kind of things, so it doesn't take much to figure out the small little tactical effects that you have to do, that you need very, very, very small tactical measures that you need to weaken the effect of the pandemic.
If we think about things in probabilistic terms, Nassim, are firms such as JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs doing the right thing by ordering traders back to the office?
I mean, I don't think it makes a big difference because overall, you need the confidence of restaurant goer, you see? You need the confidence of the regular citizen who you know, will no longer rent an apartment on 44th floor of a building with only two elevators or three elevators. You see, I would take 1 hour and 45 minutes to get to your place once in a while. So you had to bring that back. People had the illusion that government actions are causing the slowdown of economic activity, but you can see the numbers in Sweden. In Sweden, the government, you know, just gave vague guidelines and nothing mandatory. I mean, few things were mandatory, and sure enough, restaurants were empty. And New York City, it's not the government or the local government that bankrupted the restaurants. It's a risk aversion of government workers. So there is one effect here that we realize is running COVID. It is the legal system as well. So what happened is that when you ask, hey, why are we reacting so much COVID when maybe it's not as much of a killer as other diseases we've had in history, I'll tell you, the times are different. Every time a plane crashes, you see, billions and hundreds of billions are spent to make, you know, the flying safer. So there are classes of things for which, because the consumer can switch from flying to driving, although it's not wise, they can still do it. And it's the same thing. The consumer prefers to work from home or prefer to eat at home than eat in a restaurant. And the individual, the employee, prefers to work from home than work in a thing. So office safety is something quite central in determining the behavior of people, and that risk aversion is greater today than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. And that's very costly economically. So it's not the fault of governments, it's just how the system is built. So all we have So all we have to do now is imagine a system that's more robust to these kind of shocks, rather than try to patch around things that are existing.
So, you know, our viewers and listeners may be familiar with a concept that you coined, Nassim, anti-fragility.
Yes.
And as you point out, right, this pandemic is putting many of our systems, our social systems, our political systems, our economic systems under extreme stress. Which of those systems, in your mind, is passing Taleb's anti-fragile test, and which systems are failing?
So I'm going to have a positive answer and then a sort of less positive answer. So let me start with the good news. To me, an anti-fragile system is a system that is better off after a shock. Okay? And it looks like the world today is vastly more robust to the next pandemic than it was a year ago. So should we get that lab, you know, or that weird disease, okay, or that antibiotic resistant bacteria that escaped from some hospital and that we can't control? Should we get that one, we are really equipped to face it, you see? So we are better off in that sense. In other words, that you have, we did the dress rehearsal and now we train, like some people are trained to face the next pandemic. So that's a good news. Another good news is that but the parts of the economy that are fragile, very fragile, have been sort of like wrecked by, I mean, not fully because there is a Fed, but their businesses are not robust, that that have been shaken by the pandemic. Sometimes, not enough. For example, airlines, they like to spend their cash instead of, you know, keeping it for the rainy day. They like to spend their cash buying back their stock, and they were stuck with no cash. Okay, so or less cash than they would like to have. They didn't face that possibility. So anyway, so there are sectors that are now better off, you know. And then, of course, we're using this platform. I don't think that you and I would have ever imagined having using Zoom or other techniques. And so many conferences are taking place offline, and the educational system is improving and at much cheaper costs. So there are like some benefits from the shock. But the way I explain anti-fragility is as follows. if I jump 1 meter, it's very good for my bones. It's very good for my system. It's a very good stressor. It would build, make me stronger for the next time. But if I jump 100 meters or 10 meters, it's not that good. So what you want is prevent that big shock, you see? And it looks like people aren't aware of the need to do that. And they're still in the discourse, haven't gotten how to handle such a pandemic. Like, it's much easier to kill it in the egg than have to deal with it later. And also that the cost of the pandemic may be greater, I'm not talking about economically, health-wise, than we think, because we have so many unknowns, like namely morbidities. We don't know how they play out in the future by people who have very mild symptoms but seem to have something, you know, that stays in the system. And we don't know, the long-term health cost and even economic cost of that. So they are sort of bigger risk other than mortality in that pandemic that we don't see. And we're still fragile to that, and the discourse doesn't seem to have incorporated it.
Can we extend some of that thinking or explore the consequences or implications of that thinking, Nassim, for investments? And what I mean specifically is if we're better prepared for a pandemic because we understand that not being prepared is too costly,
yes,
is that going to, it seems that what flows logically from that is that the money that was previously used, say, by airlines to buy back stock or to pay dividends or whatever the case may be, is now going to be saved, held back to prepare for the next disaster.
Exactly.
And because that money won't circulate as it might have otherwise, it's going to have a depressive impact on growth and a constraining impact on financial returns. Is it logical to think that way?
No, I don't think so, because I think that people have the illusion that increasing debt and avoiding having cash is good in the long run for companies. Because it, you know, allows more spurring economic activity. In fact, it creates fake growth because growth backed by debt is not really a stable growth. But I would say a few things about, I mean, what's happening in the economy that is positive. Look around you and let's classify things in three categories. Number one, companies and countries and areas and whatever, and pursuits and organizations and whatever activities that were helped by the pandemic. The list is endless, okay? That's the first category. The second category is things that were harmed by the pandemic, but odds are in a non-permanent way. Say if you're a dentist or a hairstylist, you know, there are a lot of things that of course would come back as they were before because there's no substitute. I mean, I can't cut my own hair. I mean, I don't have a lot of hair, but I can't cut my own hair or drill my own teeth. So that second category. And then the third category of industries and companies that are permanently maimed, okay, by the pandemic, you see. So to go back to your and of course the third category is New York City's office space, and to go back, this links now I can really fully answer or completely answer to JP Morgan and other firms forcing employees back. They're trying to give lip service to New York City, but I don't think that it would be like it was before. You see, cities are very fragile. They depend on very little. I mean, some few things can go wrong, can make a city not desirable anymore. And then, of course, starts a bad cycle of you know, higher taxes and more people leaving. And I think that places like New York City, I mean, we're both based in the area, all right, are going to suffer. And telecommuting, or whatever you call it, remote work, whatever names they're giving now, is definitely gonna maim these places. So these are the three categories in general. And of course, we can talk about countries, we can talk about cities, we can talk about locations, we can talk about areas, or we can talk about industries. That's classification. See, where are you in that classification? I'm sure Bloomberg is in the first one because you know, you don't deliver physical services, and of course your business has benefited or should, you know, benefit from the aftermath. So,
Nassim, one of the consequences of the pandemic appears to be a reversal of globalization. You know, companies and countries are shortening and simplifying supply chains, trying to bring production back onshore from offshore. And unless I'm woefully mistaken, you know, based on our past conversations and your past writings, you would see that as a big positive. Am I correct?
I've seen some. Okay, so what happens is that when people say I'm against globalization, they probably don't know what they're talking about. I mean, the globalization pulled 1 billion to 2 billion people out of poverty, you see. And the second thing that against globalization, what does it mean? You mean you want to live in autarky or in a, somewhere in a farm, on a farm, or like trade with your next, with the town nearby or something? So I view things as degrees. There's degrees of globalization, and someone, you know, identified in the category of very pro-globalization would be a little more to the right, and some people more to the left of that, some benchmark in there. So what I think will happen is a smart reorganization of globalization. We need specialization, very badly need specialization, but there are things that, for example, you may need to have locally, just simply out of safety, and the supply chain is very fragile. So it matters a lot if you're dealing with medication, if you're dealing with things that are necessary for your local industry, because a little glitch somewhere stops the whole process. It's fragile, but it doesn't matter much if you're dealing with toys or things that are less essential. So I think that we're going to have a reorganization of what we call globalization, to preserve the system. The whole idea is how can we preserve the system by making it more robust, by identifying the source of the fragility. I like this 80-20 rule that 20% of the things, you know, contribute to 80% of fragility. And within that, it's 1% contributes to 50% of fragilities come from 1% of things. So that 1% of thing is nothing. It's small, and that's what we should, you know, focus on, and it's not a big deal.
Where are those? We've talked a bit about them already, but where would you say, you know, the locus of that fragility is right now? What have you been able to, a lesson, if you will, of the pandemic? What has it taught us about fragility?
I mean there's one thing that was completely absolutely absurd, is to have one single country and within that country one single area produce, and I won't name the country nor, you know, let you guess, produce such a high ratio of essential antibiotics. Okay, and so that's already concentration. So it's not a big deal, you know. You have 3-4 countries and produce some locally. If once you make a list of essential medication, and the second one is the supply chain got both too fragile, because you have, you know, companies located in different places, each one specializing in a subcomponent, and there is a fragility. If one of them collapses, everybody collapses. So based on that, it's like you identify them, but that's not the job of the government to do that. Companies who were relying on a fragile supply chain, okay, got harmed, and the problem with those who did not will thrive. And so we have a Darwinistic process by which companies that are wiser will survive and do better in the long run.
Nassim, you've explained to me, and no doubt to countless others, why it's essential for investors to buy tail risk protection.
Yes.
And as I understand it, the reasons are twofold. One is, of course, to insure against catastrophic loss. And the second is to comfortably take market risk in the pursuit of maximum returns, knowing, of course, that you're protected against catastrophic loss. Have I got that right?
Exactly. So the idea behind, you know, everything I've done all my life, and it started when I began as a trader, and Mark from university had the same experience, you know, when he started as a trader, is to be told, take all the risks you can, but make sure you're here tomorrow. which is exactly the opposite of the culture in modern finance as taught in schools and used by quant, theorists, but effectively applied by every trader, is that you want to make sure you can survive and take a lot of risks rather than you have a tail risk like banks in 1983, 2007. Now the government is supporting them, but they have a huge tail risk. So in other words, you have stable income, but you go bankrupt. Okay, rather have more, partake of the returns, but make sure you never go bust because you have a floor of that. So that's a general idea. But again, do not advocate unconditional and foolish tail risk. It's very hard to do, and sometimes it makes no sense to do it. It depends. I mean, the way, I'll give the example because I'm associated with Universa, of a specific form of tail risk hedging, a subspecialty tail risk hedging where you focus on a tail, and then of course there's the experience of two decades we've been doing this, but I don't just advocate to go just do tail risk hedging blindly, but nevertheless I will tell you it is necessary to do it, just like I tell you.
I have a question for you about monetary policy. Monetary policy, as it's being practiced by today's Fed, in effect trying to provide catastrophe insurance? Because what we have seen happen is that unlimited liquidity has reflated asset prices over the past 6 months.
Yes.
And it has encouraged so much risk-taking that until recently, stock market indices were at record highs.
Yes. So you can hear a lot of people complaining about printing money has, and the general process of printing money. And this, of course, I share their concern, but there's something few are seeing in it, and that's the anti-fragility aspect. Is that what is a crisis for? A crisis is there, just like a forest fire, to eliminate firms early that shouldn't be, not be there, to accelerate the evolutionary process. So a firm that should go bust, early, should go bust now when the cost will not be high on their shareholders, on their owners, on the employees, on everyone. And you start, so give you a chance, as they say in California, to start again and start again and start again. So you fail early. So that's the process by which those who need to fail, you do them a favor by allowing them to fail early. What the Fed has been doing is the reverse, is injecting tons of money to keep afloat firms that should not be around, and then delay that failure. Eventually it will happen, eventually they're gonna stop doing that. And that's not part of the discussion. This country got strong because we had the highest rate of bankruptcy, because there's a high rate of bankruptcy in America. And the rate of bankruptcy—
You're speaking, of course, about the United States and not Lebanon, yes.
No, not Lebanon. Lebanon has no problem. But in the United States, I forgot I was in a 12th century monastery here. So the United States, and particularly within the United States, the tech sector, has the highest rate of bankruptcy you can find. So by fiddling with this, plus the other thing is I on one of your shows, when we were discussing the election years ago and 4 or 5 years ago and Donald Trump, and if I told you, listen, this gentleman may bring socialism to America, you would have never spoken to me again. Donald Trump COVID in its ways, Donald Trump is the first American president to do universal basic income, as you saw, and acquire stakes in corporations because the Fed bought paper. The fact that they did not or overtly buy stocks is irrelevant. They bought paper from companies. If that's not socialism, acquisition of the tools of production and making sure everybody has an income, a floor of income, I mean, these are some of the central aspects of socialism. Regardless of what government we've had in America, socialist, on the right, on the left, anything, COVID ran the show. And what policies were enacted by the US government were driven by COVID, so driven by the environment. So
Okay.
which is something quite unpredictable and quite unpredicted.
So, but we're still in the middle of the pandemic, and the
Which is,
investor, will ask himself or herself,
yes.
and perhaps with good reason, why should I buy catastrophe insurance? Why should I hedge my tail risk when the Fed is underwriting the market?
Because again, I'm going to give you a second saying that I received 30 some years ago, 35, 37, I'm getting old, which is.
Now we've lost you. Nassim, just hang on a second. Hang on a second. We're going to wait till your audio connection comes back. It came back the last time. I'm assuming it's going to come back again. Let's just talk, you and me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear
Okay. So you were answering my question about, and you were about to tell me what you learned 30, 35, or 40 years ago, and you were lamenting your advancing age. But what is the point that you were going to make?
No. So that I was told nobody is bigger than the market.
Even the Fed. That's the point.
Even the Fed. Eventually, nobody's bigger than the market. Think about it. You're gonna the policy of the Fed. Is going to, I mean, it would be too easy if you just have a Fed by, you'd have paradise. Doesn't work that way. Eventually, you may not lose control of bank months interest rates. You may find no buyers for your bonds. And I mean, you cannot, the economy, we're just based on that kind of purchasing of paper by those who print money is not sustainable.
So there are a couple of questions I've been getting over the course of this conversation from some of the people who have tuned in, and they concern things like, the point that you made about zombie companies, for example, and they concern things such as the accumulation of enormous amounts of federal debt and the monetization by central banks such as the Fed. That's happening right now. Zombie companies exist. The federal government is incurring more and more debt. It's being monetized by the Fed. What happens? What is the precipitating event or series of events that causes that construct to begin to collapse?
I mean, first, let's say that COVID stays. One scenario, COVID stays, and one scenario is COVID is out. Okay, if COVID continues, at some point you may see a very weird case of stagflation coming from these policies. You see, because there's no free money, as they say, there's no free lunch. Stagflation coming from these. And if COVID stays, and let's say that growth will come from that, I believe that even if COVID continues, we'll find ways to adapt to have huge growth in some places. Okay, and we have had growth in a lot of places, so we may have adaptation to COVID. But second case, COVID stops. Okay, now their policies are going to be inflationary. They realize it's inflationary. What do you do? Either they will try to control interest rates to put it at the level, okay, where to fight inflation, or under pressure from pension funds. You know what? I work all my life not to earn zero interest rates on my money that can vanish. So they start raising interest rate, and we'll witness what we witnessed at some point, third or fourth semester during the Trump administration. When they start raising rates, we'll witness something like that. We'll start having volatility. And the biggest danger is bank months bonds. Who's going to buy a bond knowing you have inflation? You see, nobody will buy the bank months bonds. So so what happens? They will print money to buy their own bonds. Many countries have tried that, and history gives you 20 or 30 episodes of such failures. One difference is that so far, the reserve currency in many countries is US dollar. This is not a permanent situation. See? So, I mean, at some point, the reserve currency was the Tyrian shekel. Okay? And last time I checked, it's no longer a reserve currency anywhere. It was a reserve currency at the time of Christ. You see, where people paid in Tyrian shekel. Well, it's no longer the case. So you got to realize that this is not a permanent solution. Look what happened to the British pound, and it was at some point the currency. And so you have a lot. And so I think that there's so many things that can go bad. that you can explain, and probably other things that we haven't seen, that it's not a wise situation, and it's not wise to be in stock with a tail hedge. It's not wise to not be in stock. This is what was even more interesting, is that if you're not in stock, you know, things inflate around you, and if you're in stocks, and you know, so you have high uncertainty and high tail uncertainty. It's not like if you say high uncertainty and stocks can only go up, that's fine. That's not uncertainty. Uncertainty is when you may have a compensating effect that goes the other way. And I remember, if that was so easy to rewind a thing, I remember when I started trading, where interest rates were, and Paul Volcker spent years to bring down inflation. It's not easy to contain inflation. Our neighbor here, Turkey. Yeah.
That raises an important question. It's not as if monetary policymakers are ignorant to the risks of inflation. Even the Fed is talking about the possibility of inflation. But my question to you on that subject is this. When inflation comes, will it be a linear, which is to say manageable event, or will it be a nonlinear event?
So if we look at history, and all it takes is a couple of Google searches, and you look at history of inflation, very often it's deflation in the beginning, and then you have hyperinflation. It's like a jump. It's sort of like, it's very nonlinear. And I've seen many people, including Mark from Mark Spitzinger from Universal, he gives the case of the ketchup bottle, where nothing comes out, and then you splash ketchup everywhere. So you have a lot of nonlinearity in finance, and inflation usually is a very weird nonlinear response. But let me now answer you again about tail risk in that situation. Mm-hmm. Typically, if you believe that you don't need tail risk hedges because the Fed is giving you that tail risk hedge, and if you believe that, okay, and people believe that, then the tail risk hedging pricing should be considerably favorable, you know, to the buyer.
Even right now?
Well, if you believe that, if it's priced in. So there is a paradox there that if you think you don't need it, it'd be cheaper. So just get it if you think you don't need it.
See? And the reason I ask that question is because many people don't come to the conclusion that they need tail risk protection until after the catastrophic event. March was a catastrophic event. Tail risk hedges paid off massively. And then the light bulb went off and some investors thought, oh, I didn't have any tail risk protection. I'm down 30% on the month. I need to buy tail risk protection. But lo and behold, at the beginning of April, tail risk protection was exorbitantly expensive, less expensive now.
Exactly. So I always advise people to buy insurance before the fire, and fire insurance before the fire, than during the fire. You see?
Or don't buy insurance. Don't try to buy insurance the day before the hurricane, you know, lands in Texas.
Or during the hurricane, or after the hurricane. So,
Nassim, one of the strategies investors have adopted, in part, in an effort to insulate themselves from some of the risk that has, and the volatility, more precisely, that has played out in public markets, is to allocate more money, a greater share of the money that they oversee, to private equity, private credit, other forms of private investments, such as infrastructure, let's say. You know, can we talk about the importance of the distinction between the kind of risks that one undertakes in private markets and the kinds of risks that one undertakes in public markets?
Okay, so I have, again, two answers. The positive one is that private markets have a huge virtue, is to insulate you from the analyst, the Wall Street analyst, who fails to understand risk. So let's say that we have two sisters, and one of them is making $4 a share, and none of the plants have insurance, okay? And her sister has identical business. She makes $3 a share, but she has, you know, everything is insured. She has lines of credit. She has cash in the bank and everything. Wall Street will favor the first sister, the bad risk manager in the short run. Okay, and then of course the bad risk is going to go bust, and that's unavoidable. And of course, no company will come in. I would always favor that because of Lack Skin in the Game. That was my last book. That analysts don't really are not survivors. They're not part of the Darwinistic process of surviving, risk-taking. And then they like cosmetic things and a good story. So you escape that by being insulated from the market where you could do good things, okay? And you can see survival of family businesses and businesses that don't go in the market. And now viciously, if you go in the stock S&P 500, the median duration in the S&P 500 today is 11 years and shrinking, okay? So it makes sense to be in private equity. Now, the bad news. The bad news is that many people engage in going to private equity, but not for that reason. You see, they go into private equity because they can lock up investors for a while, they can engage in massive leverage, and all that kind of thing. So here we have to be a little careful when we talk about private equity.
I see. So let's just, if you don't mind, cover that one more time. The misconception, the main misconception about most people who put money into private equity or private credit or whatever is what exactly?
The misconception is that the private equity is a great vehicle for long-term returns, okay, insulated from the vagaries of the stock market, okay? So that's commendable. But the thing is, sometimes people do that to hide, because you can make a mistake for 5 years, you lock up investors for a while, you lock up lines of credit, to either engage in monstrous debt, which is harmful in the long run, or in being insulated from the accountability to investors for a while. So that's a bad part of private equity. But I'm not an expert in private equity. I'm a tail risk person, but some strategies you can only do in private equity.
Right.
It doesn't mean that all private equity is good.
Nassim, another question from our audience. What would you say is the most underestimated, or perhaps I might say underappreciated, risk in financial markets today?
I would say that the dollar ceases to be a currency, a reserve currency. That would be a risk, or it would be less of a reserve currency.
So not recognizing the possibility that the U.S. dollar will cease to be the world's reserve currency is the underappreciated risk.
Exactly, because then we'd have a lot tougher time borrowing.
We have a long which?
We'd have a tougher time borrowing.
Sure. Speaking of the U.S. government or anybody who needs to borrow money in U.S. dollars.
But it may bring financial discipline.
At what cost, of course.
At what cost, but it may bring financial discipline.
Nassim, we have to talk about politics a little bit, at least, because in 42 days, the United States will be holding a federal election. It's an event of great consequence, not just to this country, but to the entire globe. You told me back in 2017 that President Trump was misunderstood. In fact, you said, and I'm quoting you directly, there's a logic to Trump. Do you still see the same logic to Trump today as you did then?
I would say less so, but at the time I was seeing some logic to a deal maker. He's a deal maker. He likes to make deals. And that continued. I mean, he doesn't think in terms of, running, an administration as much as like to do deals. And that continued visibly. He made being a real estate developer, he made an offer or tried to make an offer to buy Greenland or portions of Greenland. Well, that was part of the deal-making thing. And he engaged in some deal-making in the Middle East nearby, not far from here, between Israel and a few. So that was some deal-making that has been taking place. He, of course, failed in the deal-making with the Iranians, because the initial the idea with the Iranians was, hey, you know, cancel the deal. I'm going to bully them into a better deal for America. And visibly, that did not happen. So there's that deal-making aspect of Trump that continued, and you can see the logic there. But also there's some erratic things, you see, that I do not understand. So less understandable.
Such as, make some observations. What kinds of observations would you make about Trump today?
So, for example, you come in and you want to destroy the military, whatever it's called, the military industrial military establishment, but then increase defense spending. There's something not very logical. You want to pull troops out of Syria, but you want to kill the president. You want to pull troops out of Afghanistan, which is good, but then, you know, they're still there. And you want to, you know, make a big peace. I mean, peace between the UAE and Israel have never been, you know, neighbors. They're like, you know, from Israel, I think, to Rome is probably, you know, the short, much shorter distance than it is to the UAE. So making peace between countries that are far apart isn't as big a deal. We need the big central thing between the Iranians and the Israelis. And then a lot of people would be happier then, and we're no way close to that. So, but I think, so what I mean is I could see a logic in Trump, and then I start seeing contradiction I did not see before, and they were bothersome. Also hiring a hawk, I mean, someone who wants to peace, pull troops and stuff, hiring a hawk as a national security advisor, I couldn't understand that firing him. To hire someone who's a little more balanced, why hire a hawk? I mean, there's some contradiction that appeared after our conversation and made me a little queasy about predicting what he would do. I mean, you still see his general behavior, but there's some erratic component there. And there's no, like, administration or party behind to see what's next. And then also the attitude towards COVID. I mean, we when we issued our memo on January 26, the administration was extremely favorable to closing the borders, you see? And they did close the borders from China initially. And then after that, started having a lax attitude toward the thing. So there are contradictions. I don't understand.
Nassim, we've almost run out of time, but I want to close with something a little bit different. I'm not sure if you saw, but recently John Cleese, a name that might pop into your head, of Monty Python fame, right? The British comedian of Monty Python fame, said that he adores everything that you write. Now, this is a guy who loves philosophy, loves David Hume. He loves playwrights. He's clearly a very literate individual. But it's not what most people would expect from a British comedian such as John Cleese to say that he loves everything that Nassim Taleb writes. This pandemic has given people an opportunity, because they're not traveling as much, to do a lot more reading. They've obviously watched a lot more Netflix as well. But I want you to take John Cleese's role. Tell us what you're reading, what you've read lately that excites you. Give people something to take away from this conversation other than your insights. Give them something to read.
Okay, so I've been reading a lot of history, okay? So mostly it started with COVID, and then when you learn, if you read the history, particularly the one of Ottoman Empire, because we're talking about this area that was on a Silk Road, and that's where both plagues, Justinian's plague and the Great Plague, went through. So you have an idea about the human behavior and wisdom that the ancients had dealing with pandemics that was lost today. So, you know, so I've been reading history books or history papers or history accounts about that period, starting with Justinian's plague and all the way to now. And I'm, you know, that's what I'm reading, a lot of history. And I think it's solid to read history. I stopped reading fiction years ago. I just read once in a while Italian, you know, just to improve my Italian. But I've been focusing on history. And when you study history, it makes you wiser, because you can see a logic through the behavior of those who really did well. And we didn't do well with this pandemic, but the ancients did very well. They knew how to handle it. They knew immediately to just build so-called lazarettos and quarantines, and to try to help the business people do business as usual under minimum constraint, but nevertheless protect the population from the pandemic. And they were much more successful than we are today.
Well, I hope people take your advice, Nassim, because we could all use a little more wisdom. Nassim, I want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for joining me here at this latest installment of Bloomberg's Global Asset Owners Forum. Ladies and gentlemen, we're so glad you could be with us. Hope you enjoyed the conversation and that you will join us the next time